This is NPR News. I'm Dwahli Saikautau.
And I'm Tom Weber. We turn now to a conversation about sacred objects and sites in Indian country. There is a red rock called Yasha in the St. Paul suburb of Newport. I had no idea this existed. It's about 2 feet tall, 3 feet wide, and it's been on land currently owned by the Newport United Methodist Church. But several people, elders and others in the Dakota community, have said that it belongs to them. It's a sacred object. Church leadership, after a lot of discussion and conversation and controversy, has agreed to formally move the rock and return it to the Dakota people, even if it legally owns it.
Earlier this month, the church's pastor, Linda Gessling, attended a public gathering with Native American elders to talk about this sacred rock. This is what she said at the Nobel Peace Prize Forum at Augsburg University.
Many people in the church recognize that this was a holy rock. And I have told some people that I really have a sense about holy sites, that I'm always aware when I'm in the presence of them of that holiness, or even if it's not out of my tradition, that holiness is there. And I think that's really true for the rock. And it must have been, because the United Methodists over the years kept that rock in a place that was honored and took care of it. At the same time, the rock, by U.S. law, remained the church's. And then some other things came about where the United Methodist bishop felt it was really not appropriate for the United Methodist Church to be having ownership of this rock. And again, I use that word advisedly. The people of my church are always quick to say, we do not own the rock. The rock belongs to Mother Earth. We take care of the rock. But they are aware that at this time, maybe it needs to be in another place. It needs to have Dakota people as the ones who are making decisions about the rock. And we've already actually passed a resolution by which we say we are not the ones who should be making decisions about the rock. We recognize that that belongs to the Dakota people. So we look forward to a time when that decision is recognized by everyone and the Dakota people are making a decision around the rock.
Gracie Horn, a Minneapolis multimedia artist and activist for sacred sites, was also on the panel. She's with us now in the studio to talk about this red rock and sacred sites. Thank you so much for coming today.
Thank you.
Joining us also on the line, Tamara St. John, an archivist with the Tribal Historic Preservation Office in South Dakota. She's in the Black Hills, which many of you will recall is where Mount Rushmore is located. In fact, Tamara, I believe you just left a meeting about sacred sites. So I want to start with you by tell us what you're doing and help us understand how a place or a mountain or a river or a rock comes to be qualified as a Native sacred site. Is it that formal of a process?
You know, unfortunately, well, first of all, let me clarify that I am a member of the Sisseton-Wahpeton Nation.
Okay.
We are Dakota. And as the Tribal Historic Preservation Office, as a representative of the tribe through the THVO office, we do work with government-to-government consultation in the protection of cultural resources. And that certainly does include the places of prayer, our sacred sites, whether they be burials or stone features and other such things. Unfortunately, through federal law, something called Bulletin 38 and the National Historic Preservation Act, a lot of it is geared around society today and focuses on structures, like maybe a historic settler's grave site, or maybe the foundation of an ancient, you know, according to American history. And often our places of importance are not included under the federal regs. And that does make it very difficult to protect those things. The second point that I would make is that as Dakota and the Sisseton-Wahpeton, along with Spirit Lake and others, after the Removal Act of 1863, the Dakota are dispersed out into so many different locations. We are, like a lot of tribes, removed from our places of history, our places of prayer, our burial sites. And so it makes it very, very difficult to protect those things.
If you are just joining us and have a question or comment, 651-227-6000 or toll-free 800-242-2828. We are talking about sacred sites. Gracie Horn, you're the daughter of activist Paula Horn and Chief Arvel Looking Horse. Happy Dina is your given name, which means Dakota for third born girl. Did you always know about sacred or ceremonial sites as a child because of your parents' commitments? Or how did you come to, you know, understand sacred sites?
I think I've been on a long marathon apprenticeship since I was little. And living in Minnesota, and my reservation is also in South Dakota, it's different because when you are Dakota and you are outside of Minnesota, you're really lucky to be able to go to Coldwater Springs or Bedote or know what the confluence is. There's a lot of missing cultural things that we don't practice anymore, like ricing and maple syrup tapping. And so I guess throughout my life, I've been very fortunate and very lucky to be in these spaces with elders, to just simply be there and listen and participate in that fashion. And I think throughout the years, now that I'm in my 30s, it's been, everything's been kind of coming to light about these sacred spaces. And I think for me, being in those, being an audience in those conversations with the National Park Services between elders that are from all over Turtle Island, the U.S. to us is Turtle Island. It's just been, I sit back and think a lot about how lucky I was to participate in those discussions, but also to hear just the body language or see the body language between two entities and to see how there's still a lot of things that we need to resolve. And it's hard to say what is sacred because it's like, why is a church sacred and why is this okay and why is that not okay? And I think for me, the whole Coldwater Springs issue is still an issue because there's a bike path that goes right through it, and you wouldn't put a bike path through a church. And so I feel like I'm very lucky to have witnessed and heard a lot of these elders. And I think for me, getting older, I wish that there was more opportunities for other Native youth and young people to be a part of those discussions and just listening. And so I, for me, because I've gotten that opportunity, I don't feel ownership over any sort of information. And it's always been my passion and my drive to create space for Native people through the arts, but also to pass on the information that I know. And it's interesting because through generations and through time, this is information that you would hear from a grandparent. Whereas many other Native people that are in Minnesota and the surrounding areas, a lot of people don't have those resources anymore. And so I think that's where culture is shifting.
I just want to clarify for people listening, when you talk about Coldwater Spring, this is over in the area just south of Minnehaha Park. It's very close to Fort Snelling, and Bedote is the confluence of the Mississippi and Minnesota rivers, which is a very sacred site for the Dakota people, but it's currently the land that is known as Fort Snelling State Park. You're a few steps from Fort Snelling itself, which is its own concentration camp for the Dakota, or of the Dakota people. I don't know which proposition I should use there, after the War of 1862. When we have conversations, for example, about Fort Snelling, right? Bring it down. What do you do with Fort Snelling because of the history there? And then you walk just a few steps over to Coldwater Spring and talk about it being a sacred site, or you go down that hill to Bedote, which is sacred. Are the conversations about, for example, Fort Snelling, and frankly the one that you were a part of earlier this year about scaffold over at Walker, you know, take things down, these are offensive. Are those conversations and the conversations about sacred sites, are they the same conversation at the 10,000-foot level?
In a sense and in a way it is, because you're almost trying to decipher between the two. For us, the issue with Sam Durant's scaffold, that was a hodgepodge of seven different hangings in the U.S. history, the scaffold, it was taken down and the pieces were almost secondary to what we were really getting to, is that this is our narrative that is cultural appropriation, that is not appropriate for anybody to tell our stories and what we've gone through. And also to create something that's just so like two stories high, mm-hmm. and it be a trigger for a lot of people because it's ancestral trauma. And we not only deal with that, but we also deal with our own personal trauma. I guess those conversations in general, I feel like, are appropriate and are very informational, because then our young people understand what is sacred, what is not sacred. This man built this object and put a lot of work and lumber into it. And yet that is not...
That's not sacred.
That's not sacred at all.
That's the complete opposite of sacred.
Yeah, and I think for us with Fort Snelling, the discussion of what to do with Fort Snelling and Bedote, for many of us that live both Anishinaabe and other tribes participate with our sacred sites no matter what, because we view sacred sites as being a place where our ancestors sleep. So those places are where you tread lightly and you don't make a sound. You're supposed to bring offerings and that sort of stuff. And so we're very fortunate to have very strong allies. But the truth of the matter is that we almost essentially created our own Bedote, which is at St. Peter's Catholic Church, where the four sacred oaks are still at, where the Mendota Powwow is now. It's just across the river from Fort Snelling Base. And I guess what we've done is we've have access. Yes, we do have to ask this church to have ceremonies. Yes, we still have to go through that. But the difference between going through the Fort Snelling Park is night and day. You have to have money. You have to have resources. And we put it through the test. In 2011, we tried to have a peace and healing event. And in the park, it was an event called World Peace and Prayer Day. And so we had somebody that was a part of the Rotary Club. Her name is Stephanie Holt Smith, that helped us do all the obstacle of paperwork and getting insurance and all that stuff. And to this day, she still is our person that says, you know, it's nearly impossible. It takes so long just to go through it, just to say, we're going to have a peaceful event in this place where we're just coming together. And so I think stories like those are just what is still what we're still facing today. It's still relevant today. We do have the Freedom of Religion Act for Native people that was established in 1978. We still have those rights. But when it comes to land, it's still a conversation that needs to be had. And it's still a tough conversation between the National Park Service and Native people. We don't necessarily agree on a lot of things. They do not allow fires, controlled fires, inside a national park. And for us, those are elements that are part of our
ceremony.
Part of ceremony.
Mm-hmm. Tamara St. John, you, as a tribal historian, there are sacred sites and then there are super sacred sites. Can you help us understand the difference, and how complicated is this work of securing proof that a place, an object, you know, that belongs to Indigenous communities?
Oh, thank you for saying that. You know, the documentation that most, I think, people want to see would be any written document that this place was something of importance to people. I'll give you a much broader example. We had a discussion at the Nobel Peace Prize Forum about a place called Whitestone Hill. And Whitestone Hill is a location of the tribal understanding is a massacre site. And after 1862, the punitive campaign of Sibley and Sully arrives up on a group of people that are hunting on September 3rd of 1863 and essentially massacre them. And the important thing about this story is that, first of all, our story of massacre and who and the identity of who is there, the state of North Dakota for many years on their website had it down as the hostile Sioux of Minnesota. The reality is that the people that were there were not the hostile Sioux of Minnesota. They were many other bands, Hunkpapa, Yankton A, there were many others, but not the hostile Sioux of Minnesota. they were not prepared for the massacre that happened there. And the place itself became known for that. And so the tribes began to work there in an American Battlefield grant and naming it to the National Register, which is the American Society way of preserving a place, to the National Register. But it became more important to the tribes that this place was now known for this battle, which was actually a massacre, and the people were not the people that they had initially said. But more important, it was something of importance way prior to. It was an annual gathering place, a beautiful hunting ground, and somewhere where many bands got together on an annual basis for hunting. It would be much like a huge fair. There were many things that took place there. So the importance of those things, you know, I think society is geared around this idea that history began when Columbus arrived. And for us, it's a completely different story. Our origin stories, the creation stories, not just our nation, but many nations. And to put it in that frame of American history is really, really limiting. For example, Bedote, or Fort Snelling, to be known as that, you know, the one thing that when the tribes are together and talking about this in recent meetings, the importance of what this place was way prior to. Mm-hmm. Some of the artifacts that were found around there are identified to be thousands of years old. So far, far beyond what, you know, when Josiah Snelling and the site was built.
How do you, though, Tamara, in your work, how do you navigate the process of finding some kind of official designation when part of the proof you need, I'm assuming, is going to be written, and so many Native nations have histories that are oral?
Right. And, you know, for us, oral history is everything. That
right.
is how we recorded our history. But unfortunately, when you're writing a National Register nomination, I will have to add in this, though, too, that, you know, of course there is the National Register. But like a lot of tribes, System Wahpeton, we have developed our own register, what's important to us in our efforts to preserve and protect those things. And again, I'll throw in here the mention of the super sacred sites, because there are smaller sites. And I shouldn't necessarily say smaller, but that they are less known. And then there are those that are like, let's say, Pipestone or Devil's Tower or Bear Butte, which certainly are not known by us for those names and are central to so many different tribes, and not just the Lakota, Nakota, Dakota, certainly the Cheyenne and others for Bear Butte and other places.
Well, and I guess the crass way, Gracie, of asking that is, what's to keep you from showing up to a church in South Minneapolis, finding a rock on the land and saying this is sacred, and then the parishioners wanting to be woke will say, sure, take the, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
I mean, how do you navigate
it? It's funny to me because Tamara and a lot of other people that work for the THPO department are very, I commend a lot of them for the work that they do. I don't think I would have enough reservations not to say some of the things that I would love to just say. but I just feel like it's just the irony of being a Native person in the U.S. is that, first of all, you have to have the right blood quantum. We're a group of people that are under the same department for game and fish and land. We have to abide by those standards. There are many surviving, almost annihilated tribes in the U.S. that can't even get federal recognition because of that whole oral tradition standard. Like, are you really Indian? Let me see your paperwork. Mm-hmm. Let me make sure you are who you are and this land comes from you. And it's the same way for traditional sites. It's, you know, we almost have to go by the same thing. And I think for the Inyasha in particular, like, as Native people, we've had families that have taken on those responsibilities to continue to take care of sacred objects. The Yan Sha was located on the riverbed right by Newport, and it was all the people that would come in and make offerings. And rock and water are the first creations for our creation story. And so it's, you know, super sacred in Tamara's words. And so throughout time, there have been these, we've been very lucky to have these families to continue that, you know, that message of why it's there. But it's like, how do you take this family's word, you know? And it's hard, because even with the Dakota Uprising, when we were at the scaffold outside of the Walker, we took that space to make sure that it was done in peace, but we also did it to educate. And that's like kind of what we always have to do. You're a POC person and you're always having to educate. And so it's, some of us will continue to do it and others will just be like, it's somebody else's job. And so for us, it was like, that's what we did, is we educated people. The people that were in power at that time said that these men were rapists and thieves. These are the accounts from many Dakota families, many, many Dakota families that are now outside of Minnesota that say that is not true. Who are you going to believe? You know, and there's been like a few cases of rape. And so it was kind of like, how do you make these men's names right, cleared, you know? Mm. And it's almost like you don't have the power to, because of the who had control of the narrative back then. And so I guess that's how it is today with sacred sites.
Gracie, I want to play this quote from Faith Spotted Eagle. She's with the Yankton Sioux tribe. She's the first Native American to win an electoral college vote for president. Let's hear what she said. And then I want you to see if you agree with what she said.
This work that we're talking about with sacred sites, it's a never-ending, lifelong thing. I'm the chair of my treaty committee, our treaty committee with my tribe, and our elders know how long of a job this is. So when you get an appointment to the treaty committee at home, it's lifelong. Mm. So I will be on the treaty committee till I leave, unless I steal a car or something and they'll throw me off. But so that obligation is long-term. There's so much to learn and so much loops to go through. The second role that I play is way over here in the borderlands. I'm a member of a traditional society. When you look at the brilliance and the civility that our people had that practiced at these sacred sites, they had roles and niches for everybody. You all sitting here, if you were part of our camp, they would say in the old days, Ella Deloria said that if you didn't belong to a society or what we call an okodakichia, you were nothing. So you all fulfilled a role. And in order to do leadership, you have to know your role. So in bringing back those brilliant ways that we have, there's a movement I feel real good about, is that there's younger people that are waking up and realizing that those brilliant structures that we had a long time ago that took care of these sacred sites, that duty still lies there.
This work, it's generational, isn't it?
Yes, and I feel like there's one more part that she said, that Faith said during that talk, and the one that struck me, and the one in which I'm probably always going to use, is that, yes, this is Indigenous land. All different tribes have a responsibility to take care of the land. That is where, you know, we do practices for the thing to express our happiness and to express our sorrow. And we have our ancestors that are in the ground that have passed on, that have done their work for us, that are now in the ground. And I feel like the powerful thing that Faith said was that even though a lot of people have come to the U.S. and their homes are here and they've been here for generations, it's still your responsibility, because you also have your ancestors that are buried in the ground. So there's your connection. There's where you also have to ally with us to protect these sacred objects. Because I remember when I was younger, the elders would always talk about sacred sites, but also that there was a connection to each sacred site that was 100 miles in radius, and that these were like chakra points of Mother Earth. And it wasn't until later on in college I start learning more about landlines in Europe and how like prevalent it is in their history about these landlines, that their PowerPoints, right? And so I was just like, it's the same thing, you know? It's very relevant. If something happens there, it needs to get cleaned up. And there's a lot of massacres, a lot of concentration camps at these sacred sites. And whether you believe in the spiritual realm or not, like, they're still there. That energy is still there. And we all have that responsibility to be allies with each other.
Tamara St. John, what would you like to add to that?
I'd just like to say that, you know, I have a great appreciation for Faith Spotted Eagle. And something that she had said to me very early on was that years back, a number of the elders in her community had looked around and they had concerns that there wouldn't be people that would understand these things and carry on the work that they were doing now. And so they began to educate the younger generations to do these things. And now, recently, I had the opportunity to listen to their tribal historic preservation officer, a young man that would have been a part of that. And truly incredible, or to have some of the other people that work in these fields, because all of them are important, from those that are activists, the grassroots, our tribal elders.
Tamara St. John, thank you so much for joining us.